You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 9th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Culture writing that jumps off the page, dark confessions from across Ireland, and the genteel art of cricket writing. Whether it's weird and wonderful objects or the processes of the inner mind, a whole world of publishing opportunity and output is explored today on The Stack. This week on The Stack, we'll be traversing the Alps and checking in with our editor-in-chief as he surveys the bursting, burgeoning and bilingual newsstands of Vienna, Innsbruck and Bolzano. And then we'll be travelling around these aisles as we look to Dublin to hear from a revelatory new journal.
I wanted to create something that was about the writers as much as it was about their craft, and what better way than to do it through confessional writing and personal essays.
As well as hearing from a young illustrator turned editor as he goes to print with a very colourful new culture magazine.
The object is immediately jarring with that subject matter. You know, what on earth has an ivory dildo got to do with animal materials? But then, you know, and this is what the whole magazine does, is that tiny little crack, we put the crowbar in there and really like wrench it open by giving you these visual cues.
All that and plenty more besides on this edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme with me, Tom Edwards. You are listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards.
Let's talk to our editor-in-chief and chairman, Tyler Brulé, who's on the road this week in Middle Europa. Tyler, we find you in a beautiful Bolzano. Tell us, what's it like where you are right now?
Well, in Bolzano, first, for people who are not familiar with the region, but of course I would hope many of our listeners would be at this point, Tom, of course we did a very large survey from the region last year, a big South Tyrol special. So you have to, this is a part of Italy, Sud Tyrol or Alto Adige, which is properly bilingual, of course, official languages being Italian and German. And I'm standing out in front of this wonderful Tabacchi, or Tabak auf Deutsch, which is just really sort of embodies being in the region. So if I look at one side of the newsstand, and I'm looking at all of the newspapers that are available on the weekend, you've got the Giornale di Brescia, you have, of course, like on any good newsstand, you have Gazzetta dello Sport, but then you have great newspaper like Il Foglio, L'Arena, and then, of course, this being a bilingual region, you have the newspaper Alto Adige, and then it's got its cousin in German, which is called the Dolomiten, and then you've got all of the newspapers from the area as well. And what's great, a little bit earlier in the week, Tom, I was in Vienna, and how can you not love a European capital where there is still a firm belief in newspapers in cafes, all arranged nicely on a stick, so you can just fold them out properly and read them with your melange or whatever your pastry of choice is.
It does sound, it sounds rather wonderful, Tyler. I mean, it is as vibrant as that. We often sort of hope that that's what we'll hear from somewhere like Vienna, and that the scene was exactly as vibrant as you've described it.
One interesting thing is you're seeing proper innovation. So a very interesting newspaper out of Vienna is Der Standard. We covered it many years ago. And this is, it's launched as an economic daily. It's now really become the voice of liberal Austria, very much positioned as, you know, as a general interest newspaper, but focusing at the top end of the market. But they've got their broadsheet, which is still kind of what you would say is in a Berliner format, though. So it's slightly tabloid in size. But then they also do a compact version of what is already a small newspaper, which is an abridged version of the news, but still running long articles. It hasn't gone down, let's say, the route of, let's say, I in the UK. So it still feels like this real quality piece of journalism that you have. And it's also selling for quite a high cover price as well. But being on radio right now, one of the interesting things that they've done, very good radio station out of Austria, is called Lounge FM. And when they cut away from the news, it's actually the newspaper which is actually bringing you the daily news. So it's a really fantastic piece of cross-promotion in the world of audio and print, as we know well.
Well, we certainly like that juncture of those two things, Tyler. What about Innsbruck as well? You were in Innsbruck for, I think, a day or so. Anything catch your eye there?
Two things that stand out. The first being maybe a little bit removed from the world of print and media, but just how this region really wants to position itself, and I guess media probably does fall into this, as a real sort of zone of innovation, And of course, everyone talks up that game today, Tom. But what's interesting, what they want to do is they want to be the place that if you're based in Berlin or London or somewhere in Europe, this is your mountain retreat. It's your city in the mountain that you can go and think about your next novel or whatever your startup could be. And they're figuring, you know, should this happen in Innsbruck Central? Should they do this up in the mountains and somewhere like Kitzbühel? So I thought, you know, whenever we want to think about our next venture, you know, maybe our next outpost could be on that side of the Alps.
Sounds very agreeable, Tyler. We're short of time, Tyler. In a word or two, where will we find you next? Are you back in London next week, or are you continuing on your global tour somewhere else?
I think that we will have to be wrestling for the chair that you're sitting in next week. I will be back next week with a massive stack of magazines. But I think next week we're going to be talking about a new running title. Perfect in time for summer.
Lovely stuff. That's Tyler Brulé. Tyler, happy travels. We'll speak to you again soon, and we'll look forward to welcoming you back to Midori House next week. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Not just me, Tom Edwards, though. This morning, I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by the programme's producer. He's broken out through the glass. We don't keep him in a case. He's just come from the other side of the studio. David Pleasant is here, and he's going to be talking us through some of the magazines we're going to hear about today. Dave, it's very nice to have you around the table with us, with our stack of magazines in tow.
Lovely to be here, Tom. And I didn't, before anyone freaks out, I didn't break the glass. Claire's safely behind the glass. Yep.
But where should we start? Now, we've got a couple of nice... I'll do a little bit of the old... There we go. What's that? This is a museum, a new magazine, which you mentioned at the top. Tell us a little bit about why this one caught your eye particularly, David.
Well, it's just such a lovely, sturdy thing. It's got a wonderful cover that we'll hear about in a minute. But we come across a lot of magazines, and I think what really stood out about this one was a kind of consistency. It's high quality throughout. Even the adverts are pretty good. Good illustration, good writing, and a nice, thick, good feeling about it. So that's why I thought we'd have it on.
It's sturdy. And it's interesting, isn't it? We'll hear more about this when we hear from the creative mind behind the magazine. But it's graphic designers turned editors, which is maybe kind of marks them out a little from the crowd.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting aspect of the magazine as well. That kind of decision-making process that comes from a more graphically trained mind, a more visual mind, actually, I think, works really well in this. And you see the kind of graphic illustration background throughout. There's wonderful illustrations, but we're really used to wonderful illustrations throughout the magazine world. What's good about this is the kind of interplay between text and illos. And there's not many infographics, really. It's pure illustration here. So we're going to hear now from one of the magazine's creators, Dan Stafford. He came to Midori House and spoke a little bit about a museum.
In my, you know, my other day job, as everybody who's an illustrator will have, they have about four. I design a lot of corporate brochures and things like that are quite tedious, really, to kind of grind through and make sure, you know, all the information is there for the client and it's in the right order and it's legible and all that stuff. So I've got quite a lot of experience of kind of making sure the information is there in the right order and that you can really navigate it. And then, you know, in my other life, I kind of make these images, which, you know, sitting by themselves wouldn't make any sense. You need them to sit next to the editorial content for them to work. So for me, when I was thinking of, you know, what am I going to do next, like with my life, I guess this made sense for me because it was like, I already make these illustrations. I already, you know, explain ideas visually and I already design things for other people, which I'm finding tedious. So why not make something which is exciting and can communicate information to people in a way which is accessible? So it seems like kind of a logical progression to me.
And let's go into the magazine, and we have to describe it. It's immensely colourful, a wonderful cover with an illustration of a monkey holding a skull. Maybe explain that cover for us.
It's a little bit Elton John meets kind of Hamlet, I guess, but with a bit of Darwin in there, I suppose. I mean, it's done by, I think he's Norwegian, Christian Hammerstadt did the illustration, and he's also an editorial illustrator. And I think that's actually one of the reasons which makes it so successful, for me anyway, because it has a certain directness about it and a certain kind of straightforward meaning, but there's also a multi-layered kind of semiotic juggling act going on there in some way. I think a lot of people, when they view images, there is kind of that first taste that you get and you see it and there's the impact and you think something, but then later, you know, like when you're drinking wine or whatever, there's that aftertaste and you're like, oh, maybe there's something else in there that I've missed. Maybe there's a little interesting nugget which I could maybe see on a second viewing. So I think Christian did a really great job at doing that. And, you know, I one of the things I really wanted to do when I did the cover was avoid that kind of addiction to white, which you see in so many publications at the minute. I just didn't want to have that. So I went purple.
Actually, that's the one thing. Another thing I was going to say is just you seem to be kind of combating that sort of that whitewash, that sort of plainness of a lot of the new independent publishing that we see at the moment. You've really kind of gone for very clever kind of text and illustration options, photography and kind of captions and boxes. There's an interplay throughout the publication. Can we focus on some of the specific stories? Let's go to Exhibit B, is it, which is called Elephant Ivory Dildo.
It is. Well, I mean, the object is an elephant ivory dildo. The way kind of the magazine is structured really is into kind of three thought processes, really, or three subject matters. So, you know, we hope that these objects are a way to get into a subject matter which you may not ordinarily have thought about. So Exhibit B is actually about animal materials. So on the previous spread, you see the front of the object and it says animal materials, but the object is immediately jarring with that subject matter. You know, what on earth has an ivory dildo got to do with animal materials? But then, you know, and this is what I hope the whole magazine does, is that tiny little crack, we put the crowbar in there and really like wrench it open by giving you these visual cues. So you're tempted to read maybe a little bit about French history or like a tiny bit about, you know, the way silk is produced or whatever. And as part of that, you learn something new and you tell somebody else. That's what I hope. The magazines that I enjoy the most are the ones where I see a visual cue, or maybe it's a, you know, a layout or something that they've done with typography. And that opens a door for me to find out something which I'd otherwise ignored or didn't know existed. If a magazine can't do that, for me, it's not worth reading.
And I love this story. And as you say, it really takes you on a journey. You don't know where you're starting with this beautifully sculpted elephant ivory dildo, but you really have no idea. But it takes you on a journey through objects, through different materials. The start, I mean, it's wonderful writing as well, may I say. So if we just kind of set the scene, you say, even the most stringent vegan's house is full of animal material secreted into the banal and unexpected. Cow hoof in your fire extinguisher, silk in your wardrobe, whale teeth in your hairbrush, crustaceans in the toothpaste, porcine valve transplants in your grandfather's heart. So that's really setting the scene. And then you sort of go through it with some really quite tongue-in-cheek titles like Horny, 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 Funny Boners.
Yeah, it's 100% British seaside postcard. That's what I want it to be. You know, when I was initially pitching the idea to people who wanted to be involved with it, and before I had this object, and there isn't really anything like it, or I hope there isn't. I hope it seems like it's quite an original idea, where, you know, of combining two different ingredients. The way I pitched it to people was, you know, I want it to be somewhere between National Geographic, so super, super highbrow, and then Viz magazine, like super lowbrow. So I want, you know, fat slags, and then I want something about ancient Chinese history, and I want those two to sit together. And I think there's a lot those two can help each other with, and they don't have to exist in these separate universe. And I think it's a shame, because I think that, you know, the most intelligent people are the people with the best sense of humour, I like to think. And I think, well, I hope a museum is like, is that thing for that people, that thing that you're a clever person and you like reading and you like facts and you like being entertained, you know, it's a thing which can do that for you. And when you know, whether you've got 10 minutes on the tube or whether you've got 3 hours, you can really feel like you've had, you know, like a filling dinner after you've had it, rather than it being kind of snacky, you know. Or if you're into snacks, there's snacks in there too.
And as you say in this exhibit too, this object quite literally fills that hole. So,
I love a pun. A pun, David. Can't get enough of
exactly.
Puns.
So let's go on from that. And maybe if we could talk a short while about the more practical matters in terms of starting a magazine and how that process has been. It's had quite an impact in London, certainly. You've managed to get it on all the important shelves, all the racks that matter.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. How have you gone about starting and distributing and getting the funds together and all the rest of it?
The process as a whole has been, I can't even remember when it started. That's probably my tagline for how I think magazines probably begin. You know, it seems like it started as this seed of an idea forever ago. And it was only kind of when the idea got to the right point that it kind of came out of me, I guess, and became the thing that it is. And then, you know, at the beginning, it seems like this kind of unsurmountable task. Like, you know, who do you talk to about putting it on the shelves? Where are you going to get the money for doing it? Who's going to be in it? How are you going to fund the next one? All these questions, because, you know, it's borderline
did listening
impossible.
To the Stack help at all?
I am the Stack's number one founder. I used to be a year ago. I was just saying earlier to one of your colleagues that, ironically, as soon as I started making the magazine, I had no time to listen to the Stack anymore, but definitely taught me a lot about the pitfalls there are for people to fall into. As well, people who are in power, like Mark Valley, for example, from Magma, I wouldn't have known that he has kind of the amount of power and impetus over the industry unless I'd listened to you guys talking about it. And also hearing about new publications that I will then go out and buy and then kind of do my own review later. So, for example, I remember there's a Spanish title called Fuet, which is about food, which I remember reading. And I remember when you reviewed it, I thought it was going to be one thing, and then I bought it and it was a completely different thing. And I find that really fascinating, that I think magazines are so much about identity that when one person sees it, they can really see something kind of dazzling and exciting for them, and another person is completely flat and they're not interested.
Maybe if we go back to a museum, what's the kind of reaction been? How has it gone for you? Have you been impressed?
Am I allowed to say I've been impressed? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, people have responded really, really positively to it. And I think the thing which I think makes it successful and what makes people react in that way is because it isn't really like anything else. And when you're not like anything else, there's a lot of kind of scope to get it right because, you know, you haven't seen other versions of it. And that kind of refreshing quality is really great for the first one. I think the thing that's going to be difficult is the second one, because immediately, you know, I'm now putting together what's going to be in it, and you know, you can't do the exact opposite. You've got to kind of keep a certain level of repetition in there, because I think readers find that comforting. There's got to be kind of a certain level of a formulaic approach and stuff, and it's also, you know, developing the voice of it the same way I develop the voice of, you know, my artwork. It's like it's got to have a really strong visual identity, but without that kind of being a crippling, suffocating weight to carry around when you're kind of trying to navigate these subject matters, which other people don't, I hope.
Certainly a strong visual identity, David, on the pages of A Museum, and some great content as well. Everything from the sublime to ridiculous, ivory, sex aids, you name it, it's in there.
Exactly, and I can't actually wait to start reading this properly, you know, cover to cover. I've only read a few excerpts, so I want to sit down and read the whole thing now.
Good stuff. This is The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and David Pleasant. Today, we are off to Ireland next.
Monocle Films explores the art of a warm welcome with Fabrica's design team to celebrate a special collaboration with Airbnb at the Palazzo Crespi in Milan.
Traveling is like life, and it's about the way we put things together, and slowly, slowly, if you cook it well, it can become something. And then you rearrange it, you design it.
Housewarming, design ingredients for a welcoming experience. Now playing in the film section of Monocle.com.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and David Pleasant here with me in Studio One at Midori House. Now, indeed, we are going to cross the Irish Sea to Dublin. And David, we're talking about, what do you call it, this genre? I guess confessional writing is the name of it.
Yeah, I think there is a bit of a genre, an undercurrent of magazine types at the moment, that kind of revelatory, very personal side of publishing. I think there is something sort of innately attractive about reading about someone's secrets and inner thoughts. That can be a little bit overindulgent sometimes, so I think there's a fine line between that. And this magazine that we're going to hear about next is called Guts, is from Dublin. Interesting that it comes from Dublin. This isn't the first magazine we've heard from Dublin. I think it's probably the third in the last year or two. So there seems to be something happening there, and I just love an Irish accent.
Well, there's plenty of Irish accents on the way, David, because we're going to hear about Guts magazine from the lilting tones of our own Barbara Feeney, formerly a colleague of yours and mine here at Midori House. Barbara, in Dublin, went to meet the editor and publisher of Guts, Roisin Agnew.
What we wanted to do was essentially give writers a sort of bigger part to play in a magazine. Everything I'd been seeing was sort of about, was either very design focused to the point where content was really a minor player, and the writers were the least important sort of characters in the production of the magazine. And I wanted to create something that was about the writers as much as it was about their craft, and what better way than to do it through confessional writing and personal essays.
The second issue of Guts is about to come out, but let's just look to the first issue. Tell me about the theme and where the idea came from, and a little bit about what we can read in the magazine.
For our first ever issue, we stole the title of a Carson McCullers book that I love, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. And our idea was that we wanted to tackle kind of ideas and stories around heartbreak and bus stops and love. I suppose the idea for me was that if it was going to be a confessional thing, and it's supposed to be a highly personalized sort of storytelling form, what better way to kind of get into it than by talking about love and kind of stuff that's a little cringy, a little sappy, but I thought it kind of worked. So we started that way. And then the other reason was that the illustrator who I was working with in the first issue, Mick Minogue, I knew he was kind of a bit of a sucker for that kind of theme and that kind of heartbreak, ideas around heartbreak and stories around heartbreak. So it sort of worked for me to do that with him. What we did with issue one was essentially try to get writers to do their best to tell stories around heartbreak and love in a way that would be exposing and kind of a little bit raw. I think for the first one it was kind of tricky because Guts didn't exist at all. We hadn't got any feedback. There wasn't any buzz around it.
You said that it's for sale in Hamburg and Paris. Is there kind of an Irish edge on it? Does it tell us anything about Dublin or Irish writers? Or were you trying to get that across in Guts?
Yeah, it's really funny. I mean, a lot of the people who I would have approached were people I knew vaguely, either my friends and stuff. So they were all Dublin based or I'd met them in Dublin. And I think they do offer a very Dublin perspective on stuff, even if the stories maybe take place somewhere else or the person writing them lives somewhere else. Like you had someone who's based in Paris, a good few people based in New York, another person based in Berlin. But the thing about Dublin is that it being this kind of urbane village where people sort of seem to come and go and live elsewhere, and it is just sort of a place of transit, I don't know if you can call it that. It's something that people like seem to pass through. It has such a kind of little magic to it. It's sort of bound to stick. So if you put a bunch of stories together of people who have at some point been in Dublin, and that's kind of the glue of the whole thing, that's the kind of the central connecting thing, I think it does offer a very diverse but very Dublin specific experiences.
As well as the stories in Guts, there is beautiful artwork and illustrations. Can you tell me about these? And I know you mentioned the illustrator a little bit earlier, but just tell me about the ideas and where the ideas for these came from.
I think the illustration was a really vital point of trying to figure out Guts, because like we sort of made a decision to not use photography at all. And then like immediately though, in our first issue, it was kind of a combination of photography and illustration, which was kind of funny because like our whole thing was like, no, we're going to stick with illustration. But I think we approached illustration and wanted to do illustration just because it's been having such a moment, and it's such a kind of, feels like it's a kind of art form at the moment that has a lot of energy and a lot of potential and that people really enjoy. And we wanted to bring the two things together. We want to bring together illustration with longer form writing, something that's kind of slightly literary or slightly personal. And we wanted to kind of give these things, which is sort of the idea of kind of creative writing in general, to me at least, in my kind of Dublin experience of it, is that it always feels quite highbrow, it feels quite exclusive, and it feels almost, a lot of the magazines or literary reviews I'd know from around here, I almost feel like they feel that if you make it beautifully designed or you focus too much on the artwork aspect of things, what you're doing is you're taking away from the seriousness or the literary worth of what you're doing. And my idea was to say, no, this is accessible. We want this to be accessible. We don't want it to be highbrow. And we are interested in the fact that it's beautiful. Like, it's important to us that, like, it looks well and is slick. So hence, we were immediately gravitated towards illustration.
David, interesting to reflect on illustration. You were talking about a museum, and again, beautiful illustrations, very sort of contemplative, but a huge range in the pages of Guts magazine. That's another nice looking, very different tone, very sort of slim, almost kind of zine-y quality, but a pleasure to peruse.
Exactly, and I think that it's sort of coming together how illustration is a kind of core aspect of, you know, if you're starting a magazine, I think it's a core tenet of what is at your disposal as a young publisher. Get a good illustrator on board, ask your friends, you know, everybody knows somebody who's doing something good with pen and paper. Well, you know, people in this kind of environment. So, you know, good illustration is kind of key, I think, or can be key to really a successful magazine.
We're talking about illustration there, but we also do fixate somewhat on the printed word, on the printed page, don't we, David? And we're going to end the programme with, a bit of series, a new series we've got going, a new feature. Each week, one of Monocle's editors speaks out in praise of something they always appreciate on the newsstand. Each week, we reflect on a different title. Today, our culture editor here at Midori House, Robert Bound, looks at The Night Watchman, the surprisingly contemporary quarterly journal to come from that bastion of English sporting tradition, the Wisden Cricketers' Almanac. Let's hear from Rob.
I first heard of and found the Night Watchman magazine when one of its key writers, Lawrence Booth, who writes for its daddy publication, is the editor of its daddy publication, The Wisden, the annual famous bookish, Bible-ish, yellow cricketing almanac, wrote a piece in a newspaper about it and drew my attention to it.
Catch!
Oh, I dropped it!
One of the key things I like about it is the title, The Night Watchman. For those non-cricket-loving listeners, The Night Watchman is the human sacrifice in the game of cricket that comes out when a key batsman has got out at the end of a day's play and, for tactical reasons, a non-batsman, normally a bowler, sometimes a number 11 batsman, is sent out as a sort of human sacrifice to the wicket to try and bat out the last two or three remaining overs of the game. And the cover, although the cover stays the same for all of the different editions of The Night Watchman, they just switch up the colours on the cover, but the cover features a pretty terrified-looking batsman. You can see the whites of his eyes through his helmet grille. So that's why it's called The Night Watchman, and that's where I first heard about it.
I think you read that one quite as well.
I'm picking through one of the recent editions of the magazine. Matthew Engel, the great writer, was formerly the editor of Wisden. He's had a recent book out where he's toured the counties of England, actually in a sort of political and in a social history way, but he picks that apart to write about cricket. There's another archetypal story written by Nick Harrison about doing the scoring for his school cricket team, which is sort of very charming. And my friend Scott Murray has written an archetypal feature for The Night Watchman entitled Where Have All the Fat Bastards Gone? Scott Murray bemoans the new athletic cricketer, and it's almost inevitably added to by a photograph of David Boone, the great Australian batsman, who famously drank 52 tinnies of Victoria Bitter on the flight from Sydney to London for an Ashes test. I'll just give you a flavour of Scott Murray's piece. An obsession with athleticism is threatening to ruin modern cricket. It's threatening to ruin all other sports too, with the obvious exception of athletics, though some pursuits are gamely holding out. In golf, for example, last year's PGA Championship was won by Jason Duffner, a pleasingly pudgy somnambulist shuffler whose response to winning his first major was to fill up the Wanamaker Trophy, one of the most voluminous prizes in professional sport, with dirty 49-cent tortillas from the nearest Taco Bell. So, as you can hear, it is a sports publication, but one that likes to take a studiedly, perhaps, sidelong view at their favourite sport, which is cricket.
And there's a wicket played on.
That was Monocle's culture editor Robert Baum speaking in praise of The Night Watchman, the quarterly journal from the Wisden Cricketers Almanac. David Pleasant, Wisden, have you got all the back issues on your shelves at home?
It's one of those English sort of mysteries. I really don't know what it is. I've sort of seen it in my life, these yellow books, but I've tried to delve into it. It's just match scores.
Well, it's all the data, but it's more than that. It kind of captures the whole, all of the sort of mystery and wonder of the sort of English cricketing tradition. Has that prompted you to maybe take a second look?
I might.
Our listeners won't be able to see this, but you look doubtful, I think I can say.
Do you know what? I might have a delve into the Night Watchman, but I don't. I think I'll leave Wisden where it is.
That brings us to the end of this 141st edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. My producer and guest today was David Pleasant here in the studio. Behind the glass, as ever, Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome, as they always are. info@monocle.com is the email you need. And don't forget to tune in at the same time next Saturday. You can listen again if you'll miss us before then via iTunes or at monocle.com. But for now, that's all we've got time for. Goodbye.